Welcome to the Almost Reckless podcast. I'm your host, Amy Smilovic, and our guest today is Beth Hutchins, the founder and creative director of Foundry Fine Jewelry. You weren't Hutchins when I met you. It was Bug Decay, right?
No, I was always Hutchins. Beth Hutchins. Yeah, starting in 1996. And then, I met you in 1997, I believe.
Did you walk up to me at the Coterie
yes,
show?
Yes, yes.
So the quick background here is...
Yes.
I have known Beth since she was the founder, partner with Rebecca Taylor of the brand Rebecca Taylor.
Yeah.
And you started in 97?
96.
96. Uh-huh. 96. And I started in 97.
Yeah.
And we were kind of a very small handful of female owned brands at the time. And Beth was, you came up and just introduced yourself to me.
Yeah.
Which was amazing because people didn't really do that.
No,
why not, though?
You know, it's so funny because I don't know, but I happen to be friends with a lot of people in the fashion industry, and everyone would tell me that they're not friends with anybody else.
Yeah.
But I would always be friends.
Yeah, you were good at that.
I wasn't the designer.
Uh-huh.
Rebecca was, and I feel like maybe that made things easier for me to be friends with other people, so it didn't feel as threatening or something. I'm not sure.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not a trained designer, so I never felt threatened in that other way that maybe other designers would have. I always wanted to be friends, but I was too nervous to go up to people. So you were like, you had the balls to do it, too.
Oh, that's good. No, I guess I'm from Texas, so I'm just friendly.
They're so friendly.
I still, to this day, every time I move, I bring, you know, I bring cookies to my neighbors because no one ever brings them to me here. So, but I'll still do it. And even now when we open up Foundry stores, I will always bring a plate of cookies to all the stores around me and invite them over to come over.
God.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
Okay, so that's a niceness for me to aspire to.
Yeah.
So you just dropped the name Foundry, and that is why Beth is here with us today. Well, not why, but Beth, you started Rebecca Taylor then in 1996.
Yes.
And you are now the vision, creative director, founder, everything behind the incredible jewelry collection, Foundry. And do you refer to it as a jewelry collection, or how do you...
You know, it's so funny that you say that because
what's
I don't.
The terminology?
You know, I always say, I always just say Foundry, and then I say tools of self-discovery and self-expression. And I guess I've never wanted to say, I never really define ourselves as a fine jewelry business, even though we are.
Very much.
Because it was the symbols that came first for me.
Yeah.
And so... I built like the lexicon of symbols and the whole idea behind it. And then I was really trying to figure out the vehicle in which I would kind of present those symbols on. And so the idea of the jewelry came secondary.
So you went from, I mean, you've got this thriving clothing business, right? Brand. And then you sell off.
Yeah.
And then you exit the company that you've sold to.
Yeah.
How long were you at the company that you sold to? Was it Kelwood?
Kelwood. Yeah. We sold. I had a 3-year contract with them.
Yeah.
And then I had signed another 3-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after I had signed the second 3-year contract that just a couple months in, I thought, what am I doing?
So let me explain to people who don't realize, like some people think that when you have a business and then you sell it, you get this big fat check and then you get to walk away.
Right.
But you don't. There's an albatross a lot of time that gets wrapped around your neck to stay for a while. I mean, you can structure all different types of deals, but when you stay, that has the best.
We were pretty fortunate, honestly, because we did get a nice value for the company right when we sold it.
Yeah.
But it was kind of, rather than albatross, it was more like a carrot.
Yeah.
Because we had earnouts.
Uh-huh.
So then we still got to benefit from the profitability of the business.
Yes.
And so.
And you know, Kelwood turned us down. They were looking at.
I mean, amazing.
But they were.
And the funny thing
you
is.
You got chosen.
No, but, and I was going to say, and then who, they bought someone else. That's
Vince. Was no, Vince
yeah,
before
Vince.
You
and
were...
then Vince ended up being our actually parent company later. But no, somebody else. I can't even think. They don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously they made a bad decision.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so you leave this Kelwood relationship.
Yeah. Well, so the point is I was, you know, still on an earnout, making a salary, and so it was a very lucrative role.
Yeah.
But I had really lost all passion for what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I
and you were doing the production side.
I
and
was
then
the CEO,
running the company.
Yeah, yeah, I was the CEO. So I
and production was your skill set that you went in with.
No,
or
I mean, gosh.
I didn't know what like. What were you?
Yeah, I mean,
what's
technically,
your degree? Dial back all
economics.
The way. Uh-huh. Okay,
but technically, I mean, I was an assistant designer at Cynthia Rally, and Rebecca was an assistant designer too. But you know, had more of a defined point of view.
Yeah,
you know, at that point of time, and so, but
defined point of view, like a pragmatic
for her own style
business. Okay,
you know, meaning like. This real feminine romantic style.
Yeah.
And where for me at the time, like every day I would look like a different person.
Yeah.
You know, and so.
Yeah, and that's hard, right? Like, I mean, in our business, that's
yeah, I mean,
hard
that's,
for a lot of people to get their arms around that there's like lots of dimension.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like that wouldn't have worked at all, you know, for me because, it would kind of be a chaotic, mm-hmm. you know, collection. But you know, there was a, you know, it was always, I would say, it was so funny because I read your book and you were talking about one of the, you know, what words to identify with. And I definitely feel like one of my words is curated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I wear a lot of vintage, but I definitely have, I would say I have a uniform because I love pants. And then I if I wear a dressy pant, then I really like a casual top, like either t-shirts or sweatshirts. And I also wear a lot of shirting. Anyway, so.
So you take this experience and then what you created at Rebecca and you leave. How did jewelry happen?
So to answer your question about what was my specialty when I started Rebecca Taylor, I mean, we didn't have one.
Yeah.
You know, we did everything.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, you know how it is. We started with $40,000. It was just Rebecca and I, you know.
I started with 30. Like it, it can be done.
Yes. I mean, to be fair, it's a long time ago too.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yes, but.
Yeah.
As I've been writing and kind of unpacking my past, I feel so fortunate to have started with so little.
I agree.
You know?
I mean,
It forces something on you.
Yeah, it does. I agree. Like, in fact, I would say probably one of the biggest changes that happened, you know, because we were very, very frugal in the way we did business because we had to. You heard
no
me
other choice.
Talking about it yesterday where, you know, every single month it was, you know, do or die. And, you know, we only paid ourselves $16,000 a year for our salary. Yeah. We were, you know, broke.
And businesses' decisions are not made flippantly. Like every cost, you really are running, you know, pros and cons. And
oh, yeah.
A break even. And
yeah, completely. And, and we were considered a success from the beginning.
Right.
I mean, our very first year, I remember we had $1 million in sales, which that was incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, every dollar, and we were profitable from the very beginning, but all the profit went in to finance the growth of the next season.
Yeah.
And so it was years until we could actually, you know, make a decent salary.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, so from because we really did everything, you know, I would say what my real strength is that I'm very resourceful and that I really am left brain, right brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I can wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
So I'd say that is my strength. And And
then what would make you calm in the business? Like, is it knowing where the numbers are, or are you calmer just like, I don't want to know?
Oh, no, I have to know where the numbers are. Yeah, I have to. Even to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, every day I look at where I am against budget.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. And if as long as I'm making budget.
Yeah.
I'm calm.
Yeah.
And so then what I do is I...
It affects everything.
Yeah. So I actually really, even at Rebecca Taylor, it changed when we sold, actually. But I always would do very conservative projections on growth. And because I wanted to be calm.
Right.
You know, I wanted to be able to... I didn't want to overspend. Yeah. So I would always think, okay, I'm going to be conservative on the growth and then make the expense plan into that.
Yeah.
And that's how I would always make sure that, you know, we would be profitable for the year. And then if we beat the sales goal, then that would just be, you know, icing on the cake. And we were, and the nice thing is we would let everyone know.
Mm-hmm.
It was really celebratory where we'd be like, we just, you know, met our annual sales goal by August. And then you would just feel so good for the rest of the year. And we'd all talk about how we made it. And so, and then, unfortunately, once we sold it, they would just constantly force us to raise our sales projections.
Yeah.
So then it got to be the other way, where I always felt like I was losing, or I always felt like I was behind the ball and trying to push forward.
It really fucks with your head.
It really does.
It really does.
Really does.
And I even might have told this in an earlier conversation, but I was talking with a woman who I love, Paula Wallace, who is the founder and president of SCAD.
Uh-huh.
And she was saying that when she founded SCAD in the 70s,
yes,
she and her mom and dad painted an old warehouse in Savannah. Okay. And I think she said that she got, I'm going to make up a number here just to make my point. But she said that she got like 72 students enrolled. And she said that when she got those 72 students enrolled, that she knew that she had made it and that everything was going to be good. And I thought, wow, if she had gone out and gotten investors from the get-go, they would have had a mandate of 7,200 students.
Exactly.
She would have never felt like she had made it, and she would have given up in the first year.
Exactly.
So it is such a game of psychology.
Yes.
So how?
You're right. I mean, you heard me talk about Foundry, where I just had a goal of break even.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that the idea of making achievable goals for yourself that you can live with is really the right direction.
So that, I love that. So when you set up a break even, of course you're breaking even against something. You're breaking even against your costs.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the things that affects that though is how much inventory you're buying and everything as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're setting it against a break even, but you're also pushing yourself in a certain way the same time.
Well, I have a couple of interesting things to tell you about inventory, which I know you'll be really interested in.
I'm dying to hear.
So it started off where, you know, we were, you know, didn't have a lot of extra cash.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, we would purchase our raw material 6 months before the selling season started.
Yeah.
So I would always, pretty much purchase conservatively.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would inevitably sell out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would put the cutting tickets in and we would sell out usually during the selling season.
Yeah.
And then we would, you know, cut to order or, you know, short. We'd always have negatives, you know, a couple hundred pieces, truthfully, negatives and different stuff. And then we'd try to see what we can do and then decide how we're sorting it.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the season, you would still have some returns and stuff. So we'd have a little bit left over. But we had such little inventory that then when we would, you know, sell it on the, to off-price market, we would always make more than our cost.
Yeah.
Probably, I want to say 10 to 20% margin.
Yeah.
The minute we sold. And I did that practice forever.
Yeah.
Because once you start it, you just, you know, I just always felt that was the right way to do it.
Yes.
The minute we sold it, the investors said, why aren't you cutting excess inventory? And I said, well, we've just never done it. It's kind of like, I feel like a secret to our success, you know, so there's not tons of product everywhere.
Demand high.
Right. And
good for the environment.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. Yeah. And then they said, well, that's not going to be a problem anymore because we've analyzed your, you know, your costs and you're still making money even on your excess goods. So it, rather, you know, this is low hanging fruit. To try to go ahead and pick up all the sales that you're refusing because you're short. And so I agreed to do this. And you agree to do this because, you know, you start your own business when you're 23 and you're sure that they know
they're
something
experts.
Better than you know, you know.
Yes.
And so we started doing this. I have to just say the value of the brand just plummeted immediately because there was always leftover product
because that low-hanging fruit rots.
So
it
went on sale.
So destructive.
Oh, it was so destructive. So now this is my learning experience.
Yes,
I started Foundry. It was my very first season, and I was with a showroom, a jewelry showroom first, and and I sold to Browns in London.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the jewelry out and it had like 70% sell through within, I want to say, 6 weeks.
Wow.
And they were thrilled.
That's good, by the way. Yeah. Like,
and especially for jewelry, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that it's very unusual. I mean, it's not inexpensive.
Yeah.
And so I said, oh, can I? And the showroom was so thrilled and everyone was thrilled. And I said, oh, can I see the selling report by style? And I think that probably no one asked for that in the jewelry industry. And so then they showed it to me and I saw 100% sell through on everything, but then one style was 0%. And I said, oh shoot, like no one likes that ring. And I said, can you tell them to send it back to me?
Yeah.
And the showroom manager said, no, absolutely not. She's like, that's a great sell through and they'll just discount it and sell through it. And I said,
no.
I said, I cannot do that. I said, you know, just if it's 0% sell through, then, you know, it's not.
Let me have it back.
Yeah, I want it back. And so I had to leave the showroom because they felt I was setting a precedent that they weren't willing to do with their other brands. So then I called Browns directly and I just said, can you send me back those rings? Because the most beautiful thing about jewelry is that it melts. So yes. I can actually take those rings and melt them and make new jewelry.
Okay, I want to be able to melt my clothes.
I know. I had to tell you.
And I wish I could melt some things.
So the thing is my attitude towards melting jewelry and losing the labor, you know, which is hot, is completely different than most other jewelry designers that I know. But it's because of my clothing background.
Yeah.
Where I feel the fact that I can melt jewelry and that gold is this renewable resource that it never deteriorates. You can melt it 1,000 times and it still, you know, has all of the same principles, then it just was so liberating for me that's always the way I've done it now.
Yeah, because literally the worst that could happen is you're going to lose your labor costs on it, and then you'll have it to sell in the future.
Yeah, and I would much rather do that, and just having the prior experience. And so,
So you leave Rebecca Taylor, the bought out version.
Yeah.
What, like, how did the notion, like, why did you think you could become a jewelry designer all of a sudden?
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that.
Like, who gave you permission to do that?
Exactly. Well, I had I had always really defined my personal style by my jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the, like, the through line through all those wacky looks that I wore, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd always have, you know, I would say eclectic jewelry.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly expensive jewelry. It would be just this mix of everything, but I just loved it. And a lot of vintage jewelry. You know?
So it's a combination of you love it.
Yes.
You've got some good pieces to help trigger your creativity, and you kind of know what you're going to like on your body.
Well, actually, so what had started kind of more as a hobby is I started, you know, taking vintage jewelry and then repurposing them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a couple of fundraisers for a homeless shelter that I had worked with.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends said, okay, if we're going to come to Rebecca Taylor to, you know, for your fundraiser, then you should have jewelry there because your style is so defined by jewelry.
Right.
So then I went on like eBay and all these, you know, vintage places and found all this vintage jewelry and then repurposed it and styled it. And we sold so much jewelry that day.
Wow.
And that was a confidence booster for
me.
Because then I realized that I felt validated, you know, that actually I do have a unique point of view with jewelry and that people liked it.
Do you find that people are consistently amazed that sometimes to do things, you actually just do it and see if it works?
Yeah.
Because for you to have done the vintage, I'm sure you didn't go back and write a 12-page business plan.
Oh, no.
Analyze market opportunity for vintage.
No.
Like it's such a...
I mean, I don't do any vintage now, just so you know, but that was before I had fun.
Yeah, so so that everyone out in Ethersphere knows.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how the very first step is literally just taking a step.
Yes. I mean,
and not waiting for permission or a degree.
I talk about. Like, even, you know, I have a symbol, for example, for dreaming, and there's an arrow on it, and I talk about it as a call to action,
mm-hmm.
and that in order to dream, you have to do it.
Yeah.
And even if that means a step, you know, and I also feel that you're never going to take the right path. There is no right path.
Right.
That it's this, you know, wacky, you know, curving, you know, you're off the trail, you got to get back on the trail, you know, but taking the steps, then evaluating where you are, and then either retracing steps or turning, you know, that's what you do.
No, I think an analogy that we talk a lot about here on this podcast is that, you know, when you look at guiding your life with a compass instead of a GPS, that you just keep checking to see which way that arrow is going.
Yeah.
But there is nothing to tell you the right turn, the left turn, the bump in the road, the cop on the side.
I agree.
It's not going to happen.
It's so funny. We have another symbol that is a compass,
mm-hmm.
that, we call it internal compass. And the reason why is because we have the cardinal directions in mirror image.
Uh-huh.
And it's a metaphor for that. No one else can see your right path but you.
Yeah.
And so you have to look in the mirror with self-reflection and then really decide what's your next step.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's about this.
And that's what I love about, you know, when you put yourself in it, a lot of people question about, like, how do you get intuition?
Mm-hmm.
How do you intuit the right next move?
Right.
And I think that you're in the best place to intuit your next step when you're doing it mid stride.
Yeah.
But if you're just standing there waiting for it to happen,
I agree.
It's not going to happen.
I agree. I think that. I feel like what I don't do is I don't second guess myself.
Mm-hmm.
I will make a decision and move,
mm-hmm.
and then I evaluate, and then I might move in a different direction after that.
Right.
But I actually like plant my foot down that first step.
Yeah.
And I think that's
not
the right thing to do.
And so, question: do you not second guess yourself because you are just so wildly confident, or do you not second guess yourself because you know that there will always be options because that's what life has proven?
It's because there's always going to be options, and not just that, but if I don't if I second guess myself or I haven't even planted my foot in that first step, then I'm already game's over.
Yeah.
So I almost don't care which choice I pick. Like, mm-hmm. you know how you're oftentimes, you know, what am I going to do? You know, one or two.
Yeah.
Really, honestly, either one of those could end in a happy ending.
Right.
And they're just going to lead you down different paths.
Yeah.
And so I feel like you just choose one, you go. You choose one, you go. Yeah.
I'm curious, because I've always thought the break-even way that you have.
Uh-huh.
I've never really overthought things too much.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been a person of, like, when I imagine what's the worst that could happen, I don't have a lot of experiences to trigger me to want to stay away from the worst that could happen. Because the worst that could happen would be family, illness, right. like those kind of things,
yes,
right? Have you had really bad things happen in your life and you are still kind of like a little free?
I feel that, you know, I've been at points in my life where I almost lost everything, you know, that I had gained financially.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
But you've got a very stable mom and dad family, right? Like you talk about growing up as a Quaker, like.
Yes. So, so the point is I always have a roof over my head,
mm-hmm.
and I can always, you're definitely right, go home. I have such supportive family and friends. And,
so you grew up in Brownsville.
Yes.
I grew up on a small island in Georgia.
Yeah.
And we were really happy. So,
yes.
And that was a $30,000 house that I grew
exactly.
up in. And we were really happy, you know? Yes. So I do think that it's like if you grew up with more, I don't think it's a materialistic thing that you are afraid of downsizing.
Yeah.
I just don't think you have real experience to know that
it's not that
be okay.
bad. Yeah, I agree.
It's going to be okay.
Yeah, like, I totally agree.
As long as health is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be okay.
Yes. I mean, there's also going to be health problems.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and even then, I guess.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yes. It's okay. You know, I mean, this is life. And yeah, there's going to be losses and there's going to be grieving. And, you know, I feel like that's why every day is so important to really make the most out of each day and to express your love and to produce things that that you love. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am so grateful for Creative Outlet. I can't believe it. Like, it's the, you know, best thing I've ever been able to do in my life.
And you've really, like, I'm looking at you, mm-hmm. and you've got on so many amazing pieces. Okay. And having spent time at your store, there's nothing in there that looks dumbed down. There's nothing in there that looks like an algorithm at a store has told you that everyone would buy this ring if it was just for this price
point. You're exactly right.
Blah, blah, blah.
You know, so when I started Foundry, the very first collection I did, I want to say the reason why we were like successful and like, you know, we started off with, you know, a bit of like a bang where, right away, we got a story in like the Sunday Times,
yep.
and then in W Magazine, and our jewelry looked really different. And I feel like a lot of it was because I wasn't experienced in the jewelry industry, and so what I had,
yes.
I did what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I had really substantial chains, and at that time, no one was paying attention to the chains. They just had, you know, thin chains, and then like the pendant was the real story. But for me, the chains were really important, and so I designed the chains, you know, and paid attention to them. Rather than, I think a lot of jewelry designers had kind of gotten the chains from like a,
like they work on the pendant, but then they phone in the chain from a source.
Yes, from like a trim company, you know. And where they, you know, sell chains. It's yeah. like a, and so a fine dance company. And so anyway, and then I was in love with enamel. Mm-hmm. I am. And so I, you know, did the cigar bands. And then I did a lot of pendants with enamel. And that was really hard to even, there was at that time, one 80-year-old woman in New York City that still did enamel.
Well, because you were using enamel in a way that, like, everyone was like, wait, what am I doing with this cigar band? Because you're supposed to interpret it in some kind of 60s way or something like.
Yeah, it was just, no, it wasn't a popular material.
Yeah.
And then to add symbolism to it, it was really different. And so I launched with like five tenants. And then, you know, the it looks very similar to now, mm-hmm. you know, but now it's just a lot bigger.
Yeah.
But so anyways, 6 months later, I'm at a dinner with like very established jewelry people.
Yeah.
Oh, and from the very beginning, I was talking to a woman that was self-purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
Like myself, I was imagining my friends and people, you know, purchasing jewelry for themselves. And so everything was about, you know, speaking directly to the person and why I felt this would resonate with them. And that was different. So then I'm at this dinner and everybody, they start talking about jewelry. And then I learn these like, quote unquote, truisms of the industry
mm-hmm.
at this dinner. I learned that earrings was 70% of the jewelry market, which it still is. I had zero earrings, you know, so that was really funny. I was like, okay.
That's so, kind of like when I started out with just, I was going to be only resort and people were like,
right.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
same
supposed
thing.
To do fall.
Yeah, and resort's like the tiniest season. Yeah, same like, exact.
You don't get to keep space on a department store anyways.
Exact. Yeah. Same.
Isn't it funny? You're just like, okay, earrings.
Exact. Well,
good to know.
Yeah, but I honestly, at that point, I was just like, okay. I mean, I do earrings, but it's not the biggest part of our business. And
but I love your earrings.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I like them. I like them. And so they said earrings is 70% of the business. And then somebody brought up how astounded they were that self-purchasing was really growing and it was now 5% of their sales.
Wow.
And I thought, oh my gosh, that's like my entire, you know, pie.
What I want to ask you because I'm a self-purchaser but like what percentage of your customer owns their pocketbook? It's their money and it's their decision.
Well, I want to say that because I was very similar
mm-hmm.
where I should have owned my pocketbook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a very successful business person that was 100% autonomous, you know, during the day until 7 p.m. But when it came to my home, I had relinquished complete financial control to my ex-husband. And I'm just going to tell you right now, that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I should have been a lot more involved.
Especially as financially involved as you were with your business than at home.
Like I had the acumen.
Yeah.
But I just, something about, you know, being a powerful, successful businesswoman, mm-hmm. you know, even for me to say those words.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have said that several years ago.
Yeah.
And you just feel like you're not going to be accepted in that light.
Mm-hmm.
And so or loved in that light. Mm-hmm. So I would really just be very trusting.
But also maybe kind of just relieved that someone was dealing with that stuff. You dealt with it all day at work. Like
I agree. It's a very good point. Also really relieved. Yeah. But I guess it's just the part. I would have been relieved if it had gone really smoothly, but I think the part that went bad is when I felt like disciplined for purchasing something.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's right because I think if you've earned it and you can afford to buy it, you should be able to, you know. And so Anyways, this is a complex subject about, you know, person that owning their wallet.
Yeah.
So what I want to tell you is that while I want to say probably 80% of the purchases are self-purchases from Foundry, most of them, or so many of them, people have told me it's the first piece of jewelry they've ever bought themselves. And so they're giving themselves permission to make a jewelry purchase for themselves, but it's not because they always do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's actually really important for them to feel empowered to make this purchase for themselves.
I'm actually, this one I wore on purpose, but I mean, it's Cartier, right? Like that was back in the day. If you were going to buy something, it had to be that. But now it's like, no, I would never.
Yeah.
It's Foundry all the way.
But
this was my first million in sales gift to myself.
Well, Rebecca and I, when we, I forgot what, it was a goal like that. Mm-hmm. When we once treated each other, you know, to jewelry in the, you know, in the, we went to 47th Street and bought something. But again, it was almost like we wouldn't have done it if we hadn't both did it.
Yeah.
And that's how we made a lot of our spending decisions, actually. So,
but back then too, I feel like you either had, it was either going to be a brand name designer jewelry.
Yeah.
Or you were going to have to go like to the source kind of.
I mean, I always
you didn't have
vintage,
like,
yeah.
But you didn't have, like, I remember when Gaia Raposi came on the scene. And
oh,
all
more
of a sudden
like
it
independent.
Was, yes. Like,
well,
all of a sudden.
It's so funny because
Anita Ko.
Raposi actually was the very first piece of jewelry that I bought that wasn't antique.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was at Dover Street Market.
Yeah.
But yeah. I bought one of these, like, you know, she had those really long stacked bands.
Same here.
Yeah, I loved that.
I bought the earring and then actually I stepped on it and smushed it and I still have it, but now I know I can melt it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There you go. So there's a group of women that they've got their own bank and they can buy it for themselves. Now, of that group of women that have their own bank and they can buy it for themselves, how many are wanting validation of whoever's at home? How many are like, I just want to see if my partner loves it before I buy it? Is that a thing?
It's not really that they're looking for validation if somebody likes it. It's more
a tipper? Like, it might just tip the
scale. It's more like, is it okay I'm spending this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's not about their partner's point of view for the aesthetic.
Yeah.
I think it's more about the dollar amount.
Mm-hmm.
So I do know those conversations I had, which, you know, I understand that's, you know, there's like a dual income or single income, you know, you're running a family and you want to say this is the expenses this month.
Yeah.
I would say that those conversations are had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And by the way, the funny thing is where I said I was only speaking to women at first, very quickly, like a few months into Foundry, you know, men started contacting me on Instagram and saying, why do you always speak to women? Because I would say she.
Yes.
And then I realized, oh gosh, like that's really wrong of me to just assume that only women would be interested in this symbolic, meaningful jewelry. And then especially because my aesthetic was honestly very genderless.
Sure.
So then I really changed where I would just talk about, you know, people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This individual's going to like this.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So for when you left Rebecca and you started Foundry, were there like big learnings that you took from Rebecca that you're like, okay, I'm so glad that I learned this there and this I will absolutely apply?
I mean,
did you feel like a better business person starting out in that way? Or
I mean, well, for sure I was a better business person.
Than a 23-year-old.
Yeah. Than a 23-year-old, for sure. Okay. But I mean, I really had to relearn everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the real experience I had that was so beneficial was the fact that I've had the experience of learning so much before that I knew I could learn again.
Yeah.
You know, and that, and so I, like I knew what I was looking for. I knew I needed a workshop that I could rely on. I knew one wouldn't be enough, that I would need like two. I knew that, you know, I understood, like right away I got very nervous about, you know, the 80-year-old woman, the only one that could do our enameling. So within a year, you know, I mean, the same thing happened to me.
Yeah,
I knew our capacity of how much she could get done in a month. Yeah. So, you know, one of the very first shows, I took an order early in the morning, and then I said, you know, and we can't take any more orders.
Yeah.
And it was like a 3-day show.
Yeah.
And every single other person that came up, I said, I'm so sorry, but we can't take any more orders this season.
Yeah.
And so then we.
But I bet that hyped the hell out of your demand.
I mean,
say that and everyone's like,
yeah, I mean,
I gotta be
you're
with
right.
This woman.
You're right. And then we thought we'd, you know, learn people, you know, meet people that way that did enameling. And then one of the workshops was willing to, you know, hire somebody with that skill. And then we ended up building that into. So I really want to say that. I feel
so
like
you kind of like revived an old skill
and at least a few workshops here in New York. Yeah. And that other people benefited from, because then the workshops had never done them before.
Wow.
Never done. And so, and it's great.
So cool. I love that.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. Wow.
And so, you self-taught yourself with the jewelry side.
Yeah.
Did you, going back to Rebecca, mm-hmm. did you have imposter syndrome there? Like, did you ever feel like someone was going to reveal you to not be?
Yeah. I mean, both Rebecca and I, for example, we took the titles of director
mm-hmm.
because we thought.
CEO's too pretentious. How can I be a CEO?
Yeah.
Right.
And then we didn't have any employees and stuff like that. And then, but as the business grew, we just kept the titles directors.
Yeah.
And then we found out titles were so important, you know, to.
Yes. To people when they come in.
When they come on board. And then I was.
Because that's a hard sell. I'm like, we don't have titles here. They're like, you're fine. You own the company, but.
Right. Everybody else sees it.
People need titles.
And so, and then we had, you know, signed a distribution agreement in Japan.
Yeah.
And I was
so jealous of you guys when you did that.
I have to be honest, it was very good for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really was. And it that was when I first paid back my credit cards.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was telling you how we started with $40,000, but then I had about $250,000 on my personal credit card. That I didn't even question.
She had very good credit because of her father.
Yeah.
Helping you.
Yep. My parents had made
little tiny $20 purchases to build that credit. I love that.
That was very important for them, that they were going to help me build my credit. So that way I could like buy my first home and get a mortgage.
Yeah.
They did the same thing for my sister and I, where they got us a credit card. And like, I think when we were 16 or 18 and started building our credit
mm-hmm.
for us,
mm-hmm.
you know,
in small little ways,
little tiny purchases, and then they would pay it.
Yeah.
And,
on time.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And so, so then I ended up, so I got my very first credit card was that. And,
so you've invested, you've done all this stuff that gives you every right to feel like this super business owner. But when you would go to those fashion events and everything, like, did you feel like one of them or did you feel like on the outside?
I mean, you know that.
Do you think?
Because we, you know, it was.
But do you think anyone feels like one of them? Like, do we all not feel?
So,
they do.
So Rebecca and I both.
At the CFD Awards, they probably really do.
Yeah. Rebecca and I both felt like others.
Yeah.
And the reason why we did was, you know, obviously, you know, we have a privileged life, okay? Mm-hmm. Like we said, I have a wonderful family and everything. But it, you know, I guess coming from Brownsville, Texas, which is a border town and not considered this like really great town.
Yeah.
You know, I think to this day, I think that the average income is 20,000 down there. So you could imagine what it was like 20 years ago. Most people are below the poverty line.
Yeah.
And then Rebecca came from New Zealand. She hadn't graduated high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she did this, this work program, you know, in order to get like the dole in New Zealand, where you had to work
like for a vocational degree, really, right?
It's not even a vocational degree. It's they make you work in different places in order to like try to get you to have a job. And so she was a housekeeper at a hotel for a while where she had like a vacuum on her back. Yeah. And then,
okay, that's some serious character building. Because I'm always like, I pay groceries, but
she's a very hard worker. Yeah, very hard worker. And we definitely had that in common.
Yeah.
And then, she worked at a pharmacy and was like a pharmacist assistant. And then she took she worked for a costume designer.
Wow.
And then she loved it so much.
That was what
she went to powder making
school. Her interest was. Yeah.
So that's when she went to the vocational school. So she did powder making school and then decided that was going to be her career. Yeah. But so we didn't feel that we had, you know, the connections and stuff like that, that so many other people had.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't feel like real New Yorkers, where we thought New Yorkers were this, you know, chic. I mean, really, I wasn't. Not cultured, you know. I mean, Rebecca, I remember I used to, and this is not a joke. We went to a restaurant and I said to Rebecca, I said something, I think I'm going to get these crudites. And she's like, crudites?
And I was like, maybe a little arugula to go with this.
And it was like crudite. Yeah. And I called those crudites. And then I said, whores to moors. I really did.
Listen, I'm from Georgia. I totally believe you because my story is when Frank told me, what do you think of moving to Hong Kong?
Yeah.
I said, I cannot move to Japan.
It's
so far away.
Yeah.
He's just like, for fuck's sake.
Exactly.
You got to get out of the country. Like,
exactly. So, I mean, I love New York. Thankfully, has exposed me to so much. I'm so grateful for it. But yeah, so we never felt, you know, sophisticated enough.
Yeah.
I still don't, truthfully. And I think that that's actually, I've actually found that that's one of my strengths. Because I think that because I didn't grow up in New York and because I'm not uber sophisticated, I think I'm very approachable.
Yeah.
And I really love everybody and treat everyone the same. And so I think it's a real strength.
Yeah, I think also probably being partners with someone who is international. Your ex-husband.
Definitely. Yeah.
Was from?
Turkey.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like right away I was really comfortable with his background and he didn't come from a wealthy family either.
Yeah.
You know, he came from a small town in the east part of Turkey. And he was a little stunned at how comfortable I was in that situation. And then he went to Brownsville with me. And then he thought, and then he said, oh, I get it. I see now why you're comfortable with Turkey.
Yeah.
Because he really, they equate. That even though Brownsville's part of the United States, it was very much there. You know, the
lots of different languages being spoken and energy and
just
fun chaos and
just you know the fact that it wasn't this very like white
manicured
you know, it wasn't what people think of as America.
Well, that's I mean, you know, for me too with. Our company is, I mean, just our C-suite alone is Czechoslovakian, Chinese, Vietnamese, Puerto Rican, Indian. Like, we have, you know, every country, every age range too represented. And there's just such a comfort level there because having lived overseas, being married to someone, different religion, different country growing up, Georgia, I mean, my gosh, very, you know, just a range of people from all over, and just it is, you know, you're just living in it. It is. It's nothing learned. It's just,
I mean,
it just is.
I mean, obviously, I find that the different perspectives are invaluable. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I really try to do at Foundry, even with our symbols and stuff, is I look for universal symbolism mm-hmm. that, you know, transcends cultures and time. So I don't use a cross, for example, mm-hmm. or Star of David, because I never want to say, like, this one's for you and this one's for you, because I'm not looking to separate. It's more about, you know, what are our commonalities.
Yeah.
I like that a lot better.
Yeah. And I find, too, that, you know, just with communication and discourse, and you probably saw this with at Rebecca, but when I was working, living in Hong Kong, your communication was so clear because there was no expectation that you were going to be thinking the same thing. So you really went outside of yourself to check in to make sure that you were communicating clearly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think Tracy and I grew up, my head of design, Tracy, mm-hmm. We grew up with very different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so we very much check in with each other. Like, what are you meaning to say here? Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah.
And I find that it's often, if someone mirrors me exactly, we can miscommunicate all day and night because we make all these assumptions.
Yeah.
So it's funny, the assumptions happen more with someone who mirrors me mm-hmm. than they do with someone who doesn't.
Because you take more time to really consider what they're trying to say.
Yeah, because it's so obvious. Why would we think the same thing? We grew up totally different.
Yeah.
I mean, Frank and I...
I like that perspective.
We grew up totally different.
Yeah.
Of course we're not going to think the same way.
I think that it's wonderful to ask that question, where especially if someone has said something that you might be offended by.
Yes.
But to say, oh, I'm not sure if I understood you. Can you, what do you mean by that? Or, you know, I think that's a really, I need to do that.
It's the only way people learn. And I have a hard time with it. I remember right before we gave that talk at your store, Brittany came up to me and she's like, you have a giant green thing in your teeth. And I was like, oh my God. Like, growing up in the South, people would not. They'd be like, oh my God, that is so rude. And I was like, thank you for saving me.
Of course.
But I think back to times when I really learned something, and it really was when someone came up to me and said, you know, are you aware that you said this, and this is how I heard that. And I was like, fuck, I never imagined that. Or sometimes I was even like, get over it. But then later on, I'm like, I need to think about that, you know, like, I thank you for saying something, because because if not, you don't learn. And I'm sorry, people, you will say wrong things.
Yeah.
Or you will say right things that are perceived wrong.
I mean,
you just have to talk.
We say wrong things every day, 24 hours a day, you know. And I feel it's, you know, it's so funny because you talked about being an imposter. So when I first started Foundry, I never talked about Rebecca Taylor,
mm-hmm.
ever, because I felt like an imposter being creative director,
mm-hmm.
because I had never been the designer, and I didn't want anyone to know that I had been a CEO, because I really wanted to distance myself from that.
Yeah.
And so that was actually, like, it was a few years into Foundry, Murat was like, I would love to, you know, call myself CEO. And I said, you know, you should, because I was still distancing myself from that role. And, you know, I was doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I was making all the purchases, the org structure and everything, but I just didn't want anyone to know. And so I never talked about it. It was nowhere. And it's only now, like in the last year, that I talk about it more. I guess because we've been in business for almost 10 years now, and I feel more comfortable in my standing, that I don't mind talking about my past now.
Well, here's one thing just that happened to me that maybe you can relate to then is people would come up to me and they would always refer to me as the designer of Tibby, blah, blah, right? my title is creative director.
Right.
I would always bristle at designer because Tracy is my head of design.
I see.
Tracy is the designer. Tracy's my Rebecca Taylor.
Right.
She's the designer.
Right.
And it felt horrible going out at the end of the runway shows and waving because I was like, I wanted to come out and be like, this is like, these aren't all my designs. Like I'm good with color and the shape, but, and it was really, really hard.
Yeah.
And I hated giving interviews because it just felt so,
Has Tracy been with you
very
all this
wrong.
Time?
Tracy's been with me since 2005.
Oh, amazing.
Very long time.
That's amazing.
So it wasn't until after COVID and when we had really started building this whole community and doing this storytelling, that was the first time when I went out on the runway in 2021 that I felt whole because I was like, you know what? Actually, what's going out on to the runway isn't, it's Tracy's designs, but it's the work of the whole company.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of leading this.
Yes.
And I felt for the first time like I'm coming out here just as the leader of the group that got this out onto the runway.
Yeah.
So it's not just about the design anymore. It was about the whole process.
Yeah.
And it's the first time that ever am I at that point, 23 years, that I felt like, you know what? I am the creative director. Mm. I don't feel like I'm I don't feel like I'm faking it now.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to figure out what those strengths are that you're really, truly owning.
Yes.
And maybe it was also coming up with almost a new title in my head of what it was that we were doing, you know?
I feel like, I definitely knew I was a creative director from the very beginning of Foundry. It just, I didn't think anyone else would take me seriously. And so,
because it's jewelry or just because?
Because I'd never been creative director before. And I mean, I never even designed. I wasn't the designer of Rebecca Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did merchandising, but no, it was Rebecca's vision. And so,
talking with so many people in DMs now, I find that any title that has creative in it is one of, is a title that most people are so, they feel so false grabbing it because they feel like that has to be bestowed upon you rather than you kind of taking it and owning it yourself.
That's funny because I always call myself genius. Do you think that? No, I'm just kidding. And I always felt like I was okay just saying
I'm good
that,
with that,
even though anybody.
My mother says.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Actually, that's something my mother never
said.
No,
I don't. I feel like genius has to be bestowed or something, but I think creative, no. I think you know if you're creative or not. You know?
I think it's, you know, I one of our niches has been really talking to a lot of business people who are like, thank you for letting me be part of the creative conversation. I knew I was creative, even though accountant is in my title or whatever.
I see.
You know,
see.
And they've been labeled their whole lives in a way. And a lot of them, they want to be much more creative, but to even, and they're doing really cool things. They don't want to refer to themselves as creative.
Oh, so that's interesting because I have a very similar experience in the fact that I believe that that what we do at Foundry is really give the creative reins to the person that's coming into our store and they create their own story.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we have the bench jeweler on the premises. That's why we have a hand engraver on the premises. And so, you know, I talk often that like I've taken the symbols that are like the words of an alphabet, put them together into these tenets, which is like kind of creating words that didn't exist. But then I leave those words to the person that's ultimately going to be wearing them to create, like to string them all together in order to make their own story.
Yeah.
And so we talk a lot about that a lot. And sometimes we have these morning breakfasts. I remember I was with a group of people and I talked how important creative outlets are. And quite a few women said, you know, I feel creative, but I don't think I am because I don't have. where I'm a real firm believer that everyone is creative and that you just have to find your medium.
Whether
it's baking or writing or journaling. And so what I did that time is I said, you know what, let's just do some collage work together. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, the next month, the same group came in and we had all these collage papers done and everyone did collage work. And the results were beautiful.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I believe everyone is creative. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. Did you have mentors? Was there anyone that you really looked to and used as a guiding point at all? Or
I had never actually thought about this before, but I guess my piano teacher was my mentor growing up.
Why was that?
I'd say...
I just figured out it was my English teacher.
Oh, really?
It took me a while. I kept thinking of Boston Amex or Ogilvy, but it was my English teacher.
Yeah, my piano teacher, Mrs. Langford, she instilled in me some discipline and appreciation for creating beauty. And where she would say, like, I could tell you haven't practiced enough.
Yeah.
And then when I did practice, you know, it would be beautiful.
Yeah.
And so that kind of hardworking ethic, obviously my parents instilled that in me as well. But I think that was the first time that maybe I got to create something very beautiful with music. And I fell in love with playing the piano. And so, yeah, and I would skip out of my lessons. I loved it so much.
It kind of triggered that and put you on a creative path in a way.
Yeah.
So I want to bring up something that you mentioned the other night, and I told you that in the book that I have coming out, I had mentioned here, but I thought it was phenomenal. But start the story with how you started it last night about how you find it important to just reach out to people every now and then and just let them know something nice or good.
I think it's incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it gets harder as your circle gets larger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like it's much easier to check in, you know, with your closest friends when your circle's smaller. So I'll come back to that. But then I think that the point is anytime you're thinking about someone in a positive way, you should tell them, you know, which is just afterwards, you know, send a DM, you know, or, you know, a text to say, I was thinking of you this morning and about that time you did this. And oftentimes I don't try to put any strings on it because everyone's busy and I don't want them to think, I don't say like, let's get coffee or something, because then it's like, oh shoot, like we don't have time.
No, you just
want to
leave it at something that can rest with them.
Yeah, that's it. I just want to say that. And, or I'm the very first person that will stop someone on the street and just say, I love your dress, or you look fantastic. Your hair is gorgeous. And it embarrasses some people that I'm with. But
I could see that. I would see my son's dying. Exactly. Like my son Charlie would be like, Mom.
Exactly.
But I'm bringing it up because the interesting story that we have together is that when Frank and I, we had sold our loft at 56 Crosby Street. We had made some really nice money off of it. And that was where we were running our business when we started out. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to decide, do we pocket the money?
Right.
And go move ourselves into the heart of the garment district, which was hellhole.
Right.
Or do we stay in Soho? And we had just been visiting a gigantic loft that was 1/10 the price of the loft that we're sitting in right now in the middle of Soho.
Yeah.
And we visited that loft. It was above the America's busiest McDonald's. You smelled like French fry grease when you were in there. But we were like, it's 1/10 the price. Mm-hmm. We can pocket the remainder of the money. And we had the lease in our hands and we were sitting at a deli going through it. And I had a BlackBerry at the time. Mm-hmm. And you texted me and you said, Rebecca and I are walking through Soho, and I just want to let you know I am so envious that every day you walk out of your studio and you are in the middle of this creative, inspirational hub.
Yeah.
And what was amazing is we didn't talk that often. I don't think I talked to you for 2 or 3 years.
Exactly.
And you chose to text me as we are sitting in a diner with Elise for like shittiest place on earth in front of us.
Yeah.
And that was the decision maker. And so while you thought you were just reaching out with something nice, it was a game changer.
Wow.
Game changer. Like, we would not be here in this loft if you had not texted me, I don't think.
I mean, it's amazing. And I don't believe in coincidences. Mm-hmm. You know, have you ever read Carl Jung and synchronicity? I mean, I truly believe that we're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that if you think these things, you should just reach out and say them, because maybe for reasons like this, maybe a person needed to hear it that day, or, you know, but I've always been a champion of other entrepreneurs because I've always known how hard it is. And so whenever I thought fondly about someone else's business, like if I went up to, you know, Bergdorf's and saw someone's collection and thought, this is beautiful, I would send them a message and say, the new collection looks amazing.
Oh, I love you for that. And I wish I could be better at that.
Yeah,
that's because a very good skill.
It's just, why not? You know?
And jealousy is a terrible attribute.
You're nailing it.
Yeah.
Like, you must feel so happy. Everyone's talking about you, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's great.
Everything is ephemeral.
Yeah.
Okay. We all know if you're going to be in business for 30 years, you're going to have some peaks and you're going to have some valleys.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do is, you know, shout hooray when we're on a peak,
mm-hmm.
and be excited for each other and really, you know, relish the moment.
Yeah.
So then that way, when you're in a valley, you can still remember what it feels like to be in a peak and know that another peak will come.
It will come.
Yeah.
So how do you measure success now? Is it different than when you first started out, or?
You know, I feel like you're going to be very similar to me, but when I was in my early 20s, I wrote a list, and I wrote, I was a happy person, so it's probably the wrong choice of words, but I wrote, when I'll be happy, when I'll be happier, and when I'll be happiest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about success.
Yeah.
And I wrote like maybe 5 bullet points under each one, and I kept this for 20 years.
Wow.
And it was always a real, you know, grounding list for me, because it didn't say anything about financial goals.
Mm-hmm.
I remember access to outdoor space.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, and then another one was I wanted a piano.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I had moved from Texas to New York, I didn't have a piano. And then it was so funny because I didn't say, and then all of a sudden, like on my third year, it had said 2 kids. And so then I thought, that's really funny on the happiest, because like, I don't know, they popped up out of nowhere.
Right.
Yeah, because I didn't say anything about them on the happy things. It was so funny. But I remember I wanted an office with walls so I could cry and people wouldn't see me. And, you know, because we just had an open office. And
did you do that a lot? Did you cry?
Every day.
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
God, you don't strike me as a crier.
Oh, my gosh. I cried every day.
Okay.
I mean, Rebecca and I would cry, and we would go out to the loading elevator, you know, the freight elevator for privacy. Yeah, we would cry every day.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so yeah, I didn't want to ship anymore.
Yeah.
Because I did all, you know, at nighttime.
Yeah, that sucks.
We did our own
labels and you get it wrong.
Ugh. Yeah. And so those were like, you know, on my list, you know, of.
And when you hit those things, like, did they make you happy? Or
they did.
I mean, for sure the kids, right?
But, well, no, but just the whole thing is.
Yeah.
I always encourage people to do this because then you know that you are really making these thresholds.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's like the whole thing we talked about when you make a budget. It's
yeah.
the same thing. Is you can continually raise the bar on your own self.
Yeah.
Because we're all ambitious people, you know, that there it's a beautiful thing. It's why you're an entrepreneur. You wanted something different.
Yeah.
Okay. And so by writing down what your goal is, and but in a way that's more descriptive, I think, of lifestyle, it helped me a lot. Because, for example, I had said I wanted access to outdoor space, and then you know, I was on the fifth floor, you know, walk up,
yeah,
rent stabilized apartment forever, and then and we just couldn't afford anything with access
sure.
to outdoor space, and so we would just put a blanket on the roof, which was like, you know, tar. But we loved those moments,
yeah,
you know, having a glass of wine on the roof, and then when it came time to buy an apartment, I was just determined to get something with outdoor space, and it froze us. We looked and looked and looked and looked, and we ended up not getting an apartment for like 2 years, and just kept in that rent stabilized apartment.
Yeah,
and then it was my dad that was reading the Post one day, and he saw while he was in town, he saw that it said mid-century homes in Westchester. And he saw this mid-century, like, kind of town called, like, I think it was called, like, Utopia at the time. And he goes, look, Beth, like, this is less expensive than the apartments you're looking at here in New York. And I was just like, you know what? He's right. And so I called up Murat at the time, and he was actually in Hong Kong. And I said, I made an appointment for us to see this house outside the city. I said, I think, why don't we get a smaller place, you know, on the Lower East Side without any outdoor space, but then get this other house. And that's what we ended up doing.
Yeah.
So if we got a house in Pound Ridge, it was mid-century, and it had this beautiful yard, and we'd go on the weekends, and that really worked for us.
You got your outdoor space.
Yeah. So I think sometimes you have to think that there's different ways to get the
to
same
get what
thing
you want
that you're interested in.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing to end on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This was great. And I knew it was going to be.